We do have about 15 minutes left, and we were going to talk through some questions about these things. But I'd like to open it up to the floor. If anybody has a question they'd like to ask the panel, you can come on up to the microphone.
Hi, Dr. Exade, Pennsylvania. What is your approach to bile reflux patients or non-acid reflux patients?
It is very unusual to have straightforward bile-only reflux as measured by a BiliTech. Majority of refluxate is combined, acid and bile, so I don't actually differentiate with that. The mechanisms of bile-only reflux are a little bit elusive, like why is that even happening? So I don't actually separate them. And those are the patients where you find that they tell you that at night they have bile pouring out of their nose and they've got frequent pneumonias and whatnot, but their testing is normal except for an abnormal impedance. I mean, you know, you have to just take some judgment on that one.
Thank you.
You can go to the other side.
I got two questions. One was gastroparesis after any anti-reflux procedure, but in particular, there was a slide up there where it was after Lynx. Are people moving more towards doing preoperative in their workups, doing gastric emptying studies to rule out? Because some papers say up to 40% of these patients already have gastroparesis, and you could be easily faulted for. There's no shortage of experts out there that will blame you for having taken out the vagus nerve and causing the gastroparesis. And my second question is, when it comes to placing mesh, and you say that you turn yours in a C manner, did you mean the opening of the U-shaped mesh that they designed is off to the left, like overlying the left crura?
I'll take that question first. Yes, that's what I mean.
Okay.
The opening is on the left side because I think the left may be less vulnerable, and that was my idea. I think you got to leave it open somewhere. I can take the first stab at your first question as well. I think everybody's got a different approach to gastroparesis. The basic way I look at it is that when I'm seeing a patient, I really try to differentiate the patients in whom they have primarily a reflux problem, and if I really search for it, I might find a little bit of gastroparesis, or they primarily have a gastroparesis problem that's driving the reflux. That's the first question I asked myself, and if I think it's the latter, the people with primary gastroparesis, I mean, they're coming with gastroparetic symptoms, I will study 100% of those people. I will study some of the other ones if I think there's something off and I want to know. That being said, if I have a patient with some gastroparesis who I think has a primary reflux problem and I want to operate on them, do a fundoplication, I have never done a emptying procedure at that index operation. I've always said, well, it's laparoscopic. If they get significant delayed gastric emptying that I have worsened, I can easily come back and do a laparoscopic pyloroplasty. And you know, over the last 20 years, I haven't been disappointed in that approach, and have almost never, you know, come back and done some. Now, I know Dr. Dunst and their group have a different approach. I'm not saying mine is right or wrong, but it's a difficult area at the very least.
So you're saying you may do an ISIN to help with gastric emptying. That's pretty much been demonstrated, but you won't do an emptying procedure first run.
Correct. And I won't do an ISIN on somebody that I think has a primary gastric emptying problem. Like if somebody comes in with abnormal gastric emptying, their main complaints are bloating, nausea, cyclic vomiting, and so on and so forth, even if their pH is abnormal or something. And I try to stay away from that patient completely as a surgeon.
Thank you.
We take a question from the back microphone.
Abu Bakr Ali, Detroit Medical Center. A great presentation. How How do you deal with the patients with the large periesophageal hernia by the time you reduce the stomach and close the defect? They have this funneled fundus, and it's hard to kind of do a Nissen on them.
You're talking about a diminutive fundus?
Yes.
I almost never see that in a first-time operation. I do often see that variances of deformed funduses in a revisional operation like I've talked about. Sometimes it is that the fundus has become elongated because it's been brought around and stretched out, and I will sometimes, to make it look normal again, I will resect a little bit of that fundus to give it a nice gentle curve to make it in fact smaller. You're talking about when it's been stretched the other way and it's more tubular, it's more diminutive. That happens sometimes. In those situations, I will use to do a partial. If you can do a toupee, I would do a toupee, because sometimes you will get those where it just doesn't go all the way around. And if not, a door. You guys think he's talking about something else, though.
Yeah, so I've seen that occasionally, much like Dr. Oechsleger. If I see that, I'm always wondering if the esophagus is short, so my next go-to is to pull out an endoscope and scope them to get a sense for where I think the true G-junction is. And if it is short, then like Dr. Oechsleger showed, I would go to a colus if I thought it was short. But I think you have to make a judgment call about how much fundus you're going to have left.
Thank you.
All right, Chris.
Chris Ducoin, Tulane. Again, fantastic talk as always from you guys. I think Dr. Oechsleger, this probably be for you too. One that is kind of a comment. When you're doing a diaphragm release on the right side, do you always have to go through, or can you just release the fascia, kind of like a component separation for the abdominal wall? And the other question was, is there a leak rate that's reported at all for primary versus redo colus gastroplasties, and then management for that if there is?
That's
the question
okay, so I always go through the whole muscle. That was the first question, right?
Yeah.
On the relaxing incision. I have seen people go partially through it. I just think you get a better release, and I'm doing it on the right side. That's all going to be covered by mesh and by scar. I haven't seen, you know, any benefit to trying to partially cut it.
There is no fascia really on your diaphragm. You just, you know, there is peritoneum. And so, I mean, just releasing the peritoneum will not give you enough, I don't think enough.
You know. Right. I mean, you can go partially through the muscle, and some
partially
people partially
through
the muscle wall, and you'll get a little bit of stretch, yeah. But I don't think that's worthwhile. Leak rates with a colus was your other question.
Yes.
And you said recurrence. I don't think you mean, doing
like
a second colus. If somebody had a first colus, you're talking about in a redo and then doing
primary
a colus.
Primary versus redo. If there's
I'm not aware of data comparing first time operations to second times, but there may be. My guess is it's going to be higher because any revisional operation anywhere in the body of the GI tract, revisional. Resections and anastomoses are higher risk in a revisional state, so I assume that this is no different, and that makes sense because the tissue, you look at any patient with their stomach after you take down take down the stomach in a revisional situation, it's more beat up, all things being equal, than if it was a first-time operation. I don't know what to necessarily do about that, other than I suppose if you beat it up too much, you may not want to do a colus, especially if any place on that area where you're going to resect is potentially locally ischemic. Anybody else have other thoughts, or did I miss anything?
No, I think you got all the points.
No reportable
leak rate. We look really hard on a redo situation before we do a colus because we're worried that that leak rate's going to be higher. So I agree with Dr. Oschlager. If it's beat up and you think that's not going to hold, I wouldn't do it.
You try to cover though your suture with your fundus, and if you have enough fundus, then you can make a point to be protective because it's the first place the failure is due to a short esophagus, then not fixing that problem, you've done the operation for no reason. So, I mean, sometimes you have to do a colus in the redo.
The other important point with a wedge fundectomy as a colus, right, is when you construct your fundoplication, the top stitch of your fundoplication has to sit above your staple line. So the leak rate should be low as it's buttress. We can go over to other front.
Any tips and tricks to avoid post-operative dysphagia in hiatus hernia and nascent fundoplication, number one? And number two, any personal experience of use of vicryl mesh in paraesophageal hernia?
Can you repeat your first question?
Any tips and tricks to avoid post-operative dysphagia? I mean, if you close too tight, patient may have dysphagia. If you leave a large aperture, it may cause recurrence. So any tips and tricks to avoid post-operative dysphagia?
The obvious ones are use a bougie and not to make it too tight. But I would argue that you got to, the point I was trying to make in my talk is it's like Goldilocks, not too tight, not too loose, because both will cause problems. You have to create a very symmetric fundoplication that's not causing any axial twisting and turning on the fundoplication and not causing any angulation. I mean, it'd take a long time to go through all the little details of how each one of us does it, but you need to have a way that's reproducible and that you're going to do every time to accomplish those things. I think those are the main tenets of avoiding dysphagia. I don't have any experience with Vicryl mesh per se.
And the point that I wanted to make too is we spend a lot of time talking about who to and who not to operate on, and my trainees hear this all the time, but the biggest predictor of post-operative dysphagia is preoperative dysphagia, and that requires a lot of counseling, patient management of expectations, because things like regurgitation, sometimes reflux will get better, but oftentimes the dysphagia won't get better or get worse, and the patients have to know that before they get into it, and it might just be an acceptable outcome for them, but you just have to be very careful with your patient selection there. I don't use Vicryl mesh. I don't have experience.
I know some people that use it, and as far as I know, there's no definitive publication saying that it's superior to anything else.
Take a question from the back microphone.
Hi, Waylon Clark from Tampa. Great session. Two comments, questions. First, Dr. Oschlager, I think what you were saying is when you see these fundoplications fail with your video and everything, people are sewing the body of the stomach rather than the anterior fundus. Is that a fair way to describe what you're showing and saying?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, that's a simplistic way to say it. I mean, I think you can sew the, I still think you can sew the fundus and be the bottom of the fundus and still be too loose and still be a problem. The most egregious is sewing it to the body. But we're on the same page.
Yeah. And then second, with regard to delayed gastric emptying, how many people, you know, do you think with half of their stomach up in their chest, when you give them a radio tracer to swallow, they consistently reflux that, and therefore, you know, the delayed gastric emptying is really masking what's just reflux.
So I'll take that one. First of all, a nuclear gastric emptying study is not perfect. We all know that. Second of all, we don't get them on paraesophageal hernias because of exactly what you're saying. Obviously, you can't get them if they have esophageal outflow obstruction for any reason as well. So you're very limited. But if there's someone who has a lot of symptoms, they've got their paraesophageal in there, and you don't know if it's paraesophageal, but you have a feeling there might be some underlying gastroparesis as well. Who knows why? I mean, the stomach is up there getting beat up every day. Who knows? You just have to let them know that once you get the stomach down, let's see how things go. Let's give it 6 months, a year, and see where we're at. And might, maybe they'll have to have some dietary changes that are permanent. Who knows? But yeah, I agree. Don't bother getting a gastric emptying study in those patients.
Actually, I go ahead and assume that 100% of people with a parasalvagal hernia will have delayed gastric emptying afterwards, and I tell them that. I don't ever measure
it. Oh, I do too.
But they seem to have a much lower clinical emptying rate than people who don't have who are just having an anti-reflux procedure for without a big hernia.
Yeah, agree. I mean, that the parasophageal stomach, they don't work. They're totally different. They don't work. You got to prepare them for that. But if there are some cases, though, that you have a higher index of suspicion that something else is going on, just keep an eye on them.
We'll take one more question from the front.
Tanuja Damani from New York. Thank you for the great talk. I did have a question for Dr. Olschlager. I think we've discussed this at Meet the Expert luncheon about the short esophagus, and really, I feel the same way. I take great efforts to get that extensive mediastinal mobilization and then do a wedge gastroplasty. My question to you was, what are your thoughts on that? I know the group in Pittsburgh has published about a vagotomy, anterior, posterior, both, to get that extra centimeter and stop, and instead of doing a colus for that, and they haven't shown any difference in gastric emptying issues, and they did have good results in follow-up. Do you ever do that? Would you consider in that where you need just an extra centimeter?
Everybody in the audience heard that it was the University of Pittsburgh who that's a take-home message. I have done that occasionally. It will give you length. I have used it very, very sparingly in the last decade or so. The person I would is the one where I think I just need a little bit more, and a unilateral vagotomy will get me enough to feel comfortable to have enough length. That's maybe in the centimeter or less range. You need more than that, you're probably going to need
to do a
colus.
But do you usually take the anterior, and do you just cut it or clip? I mean,
usually you can, my preference would be the posterior, but what I really do is try to figure out which is
ones?
Giving more of a suspension effect,
right,
because
right.
The reason we started doing it a little bit is that you can tell in certain patients that it's like a bowstring, and it's just on a lot of tension. If you cut it, it just releases. So I look for which vagus is, if I think one vagus is doing that, it's a particularly good candidate for that. And yeah, we showed that looking back on it, there wasn't any significant difference as far as we could tell in their any of the symptoms that they had.
And you'll just take it with an energy device or something?
Yeah, take it. Yeah, I don't think how you take it matters.
Sorry, I think we have to close the session. I want to thank the very great speakers and the talks, and thank you for staying till the very end.